see Zendaya like you've never seen her before.
From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes Challengers, where Zendaya stars as Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy who makes no apologies for her game on and off the court.
For more than a decade, she has had former best friends Patrick and Art, played by Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist, under her spell.
It's Tashi's game and Tashi's rules.
See Challengers only in theaters April 26th. Get tickets now at challengersmovie.com.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
I do think that there's something truly banal about heterosexual dating that is kind of fascinating, but again, not in a good way.
Welcome to Here to Make Friends, a HuffPost podcast about the Bachelor franchise, where we lovingly snark on The Bachelor and Bachelor adjacent shows.
Whether you love The Bachelor or love to hate it, we're here to break down every delicious moment with you.
I'm Emma Gray.
And I'm Lee Blickley. A 90s boy band star.
A streaming service.
LED lighted personal pods.
A deep well of underlying sadness.
Emma, what do all of these things have in common?
I can think of one thing, Lee, and it's Love is Blind, the slightly dystopian but incredibly gripping new dating reality show on Netflix.
Yeah, our new addiction and the world's new addiction,
apparently.
Yeah, we received so many messages about the show that we decided we owed it to you, our beautiful listeners, to discuss it.
And ourselves, because we are selfish creatures and we want to talk about it. So for this episode, we're going to start out with a spoiler-free, other than some like light discussion of characters, which, you know, requires us to get a little bit into some of the stuff that happens the first couple episodes. Talk about the show and its structure. And then in the second half of this episode, we'll dive deeper, including some spoilers about the finale, so you've been forewarned, along with Guardian columnist and author Jessa Crispin.
Yeah, we had a great discussion with Jessa.
I think you're going to love it. But again, if you have not watched yet,
do not listen.
Do not listen to the second half.
You've been warned.
You've been warned. So, Lee, let's start out. For those of our listeners that might not have watched this epic journey yet, what is Love is Blind? What is the structure and premise of this show?
Well, you know, Love is Blind is a marriage-focused social experiment where a group of men and a group of women are placed in this living facility in Atlanta, and they're kept in separate quarters, and they're left to speed date.
Here's how it's going to work. The only time you're going to interact is in one of the private pods.
Where they sit, but they can't see each other, of course, but they can talk for upwards of 10 hours about anything and everything. And then they decide, based on those talks, if they want to get engaged or not.
Now, once you choose the person you want to spend the rest of your life with, you'll propose.
Just like that.
If they accept, you will finally get to see your fiancé for the very first time.
And then the show kind of switches gears and we follow, I believe, five remaining couples.
I think
five
it's
or six.
Six.
Six,
yeah.
Remaining couples who then go on to a vacay in Mexico.
All-inclusive vacay.
All-inclusive.
Cancun.
And then they move into apartments together in the Atlanta area. All of the people who were cast are from the Atlanta, greater Atlanta area. And then they live together for 3 weeks and
plan a wedding
mm-hmm. and decide at the altar whether or not to go through with it.
Yeah. So the weddings are all in the same place, the same boring venue, and they must all get dolled up in wedding dresses and tuxedos. And they have their bridesmaids and groomsmen and their parents. And they're either going to get married and say, I do, or they're going to walk away from each other.
It's forever. Forever. And so that last part, the weddings, is its own big, you know, 90-minute finale, which actually just dropped today when we were recording this on Thursday, the 27th. And that sort of brings us to something I found really interesting and clearly, as we talked about with The Circle, indicates a pattern for Netflix and one way that they are choosing to delve into reality television is creating these reality shows that have more of a suspenseful element than some of the ones they released before, like Queer Eye, Marie Kondo, even Dating Around, and releasing them in these batches. So I believe with The Circle, there were maybe 5 different releases. With Love is Blind, there are, I guess, 4 now, because we had 5 episodes, then 4 episodes, the big finale, and then we learned this week that next Thursday there is going to be a reunion episode,
which I'm very excited for.
So now that we've kind of gotten down the basics, and they probably already sound totally insane to anyone who hasn't watched, but I swear it is much easier to follow when you're watching it.
Yeah, and it's one of those shows that, like, you definitely hate watch. You are immediately addicted to it, but
you might feel very icky inside.
Icky when you're watching it, absolutely. But once you start, you can't stop. Again, because Netflix now knows how to add that suspense where every episode ends with some sort of cliffhanger that you need to tune in, and then you're stuck again and again and again.
I mean, really, nothing like watching a bunch of 20 and 30-somethings who are, like, pretty hot.
Yeah, conventionally attractive people.
Try to contort themselves into an incredibly sped-up heterosexual marriage.
Yeah, nothing like it.
Nothing quite like it. So, Lee, how did you feel about the pods? Because aesthetically, to me, it felt a little bit similar to The Circle in that everyone's physically isolated and we're seeing people in these kind of very curated small spaces speaking to each other. But the pods, which were a huge part of the trailer and are really like the center of the whole conceit of the show, we only actually see these people in the pods for the first episode and a half.
Yeah, and you know what? I wanted Nick and Vanessa Lachey to do their job and tell me more about the
like
pods.
Like the timing?
Yes.
Nick and Vanessa Lachey, by the way, are the hosts.
Vanessa and, of course, obviously, Nick, as he introduces himself.
I'm Vanessa Lachey.
I'm obviously Nick Lachey, her husband.
Of 98 Degrees fame,
to be
clear.
You know, to have hosts, though, their job is to help us as viewers at home kind of get into what the formula of the show is.
Understand the pacing.
Yeah. Explain the pods. Explain how they can be in there for 10 hours. We didn't know that until we read up on it. Explain how long they're there. Who is in what pod? Do they each have their own pod?
Are they spending equal amounts of time with
everybody,
all of the other people?
Do they get to decide who they want to be with, or do they have to actually sit with everyone out of... you know, what the producers are telling them to do.
Yeah, I was very frustrated, and I hope that if they do a second season, which it seems like they probably will because it's been so popular, that they are a little bit more explicit with the pacing with the pods and explain the way that the couples are kind of whittled down.
Yeah.
We've read some interviews with the creators, and I believe that every day they were told to say who was their favorite, and then the time got longer and longer with fewer and fewer people.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, they were able to basically spend all day in a pod talking to the same person.
Yeah. A couple like Cameron and Lauren, who met in the pods, he is an AI scientist and she is a content creator. You know, when they met and got engaged after 3 days, I at least kind of craved a little bit more with
I was like, why?
Them,
what happened
3 days
you two?
Later, I'm like, holy crap. They seem absolutely enamored with each other. And I do love them together, but I still didn't get a sense of, like, how long were they able to talk to each other? What did they really talk about?
Did they like to see more substance?
Exactly. Did they talk about politics? Did they talk about race, since they are a mixed race couple? Things like that, which we saw glimpses of, but not really deep, the deep conversations that would have, you know, allowed them to get further into their love process to the point of an engagement.
And speaking of the cast, you know, the whole premise of the show is kind of set up as like, we're trying to see, like, is love really blind? Which we just want to point out misunderstands the meaning of the phrase love is blind, yeah, as written by Shakespeare. But
love is blinding.
Yeah. It's,
not
which
blind.
More accurately means love is blinding. Love blinds you to people's faults. Yeah. But
this show is really
taking it very,
literally.
Very literally in the way our modern language would interpret it. So basically to say, do appearances matter?
Mm-hmm.
And yet everyone who is cast is
good looking.
Very conventionally attractive, overwhelmingly thin, very gender conforming.
Mm-hmm.
And
the oldest contestant is, I think, 34.
34,
with Jessica.
And the youngest is 24?
Yeah, Mark.
So it's you really don't. And it's, although we see more people of color at the beginning, once you really get down to the couples, it's also overwhelmingly white.
Yeah. And if you think about it, too, there has to be 15 women and 15 men in these, in the experiment, but we only get to know pretty much six
10
men
people.
And six,
yeah, 12
women.
People.
There are a lot of different people that the show doesn't even introduce, doesn't even kind of give you a glimpse of who they are. They kind of just automatically stick to who they know were going to be in a couple, who they were going to follow, which is kind of like, you know, I still want to know the singles that maybe it didn't work out for, get to know them better, why the experiment didn't work for some and work for others. So maybe hopefully in season two, they'll learn from some of these mistakes.
We also learned after the fact that there were actually two more engagements,
yeah,
that they basically just dismissed the couples.
They chose not to follow
them. Apparently, production team was only set up to film like five or six couples,
mm-hmm,
maybe only five. And they were shocked at how many people actually ended up getting engaged.
Yeah, they didn't think anybody would.
They thought maybe two couples.
Understandably, I would too if I was producing the show, being like, crossing my fingers, hopefully for one,
yeah,
or two.
And they ended up with eight.
Yeah. I know I mentioned Cameron and Lauren earlier, but let's kind of run through the couples so people get a sense of who ends up with who and what we get with Love is Blind. First, we have Carlton and Diamond, which Carlton's the only queer single in the house. And he ends up with Diamond, and we kind of, you know, get this storyline about how the show tackles having a bisexual character, a part of the quote-unquote experiment.
Yeah, and just a warning, some light spoilers ahead. We can't really talk about this couple without getting into their storyline. So you've been warned, but Carlton expresses some pretty intense and obvious discomfort with his sexuality and alludes to the fact that he has experienced some trauma as a result of, you know, being a black man who is attracted to both men and women. And this sort of comes to a head after the pods, when Carlton and Diamond are in Cancun at the very beginning of the post-pod period, and Carlton shares with Diamond that he is bisexual, but not until they have already gotten engaged.
So she, of course, understandably, is taken aback by the fact that he didn't tell her
this
very,
very
vital information.
Essential thing.
Yeah.
I feel that you weren't honest with me from the get-go. I felt like that should have been established.
I feel like I was honest. I wanted you to get to know me for me.
Yeah.
That's always
that
been
part
the
of you,
strategy
though.
That has never, it's never been an issue with girls. It's like, it's never.
Then why did you tell me in the beginning?
Because in the beginning, you will prejudge me.
But you said it's never been an issue with girls.
Would you have really, if I would have told you on the first date, would you have really given me a chance? You wouldn't have.
I'd rather you have told me up in front.
And so she takes some space to think about it. And when they come back together, they have this blowout, which read to me as a series of kind of triggers just missing each other.
Yeah.
Like, And there's been, you know, some discussion about whether Diamond was being biphobic. And I felt like where the show really stumbled is in kind of trying to force a show whose structure is very intentionally built around straightness, and then trying to shoehorn in some representation of queerness. And again, I would love dating shows to incorporate queerness more, but I thought it was almost unfair to Carlton to force him kind of into being the representative of an entire incredibly diverse community when he clearly has a lot of trauma that he hasn't.
That he's still battling
with. That he's still processing and doesn't even handle
the situation the best he could have. But we're seeing a lot of, you know, negative comments pointed in Diamond's direction. And it was kind of like you said, the way the show sort of handled having any sort of representation in the season. It just didn't.
It was ham-fisted.
Yes.
I thought that the show itself was a bit ham-fisted and put these two people in a position where I think neither of them ultimately ended up coming off that well. But clearly we're coming at this, I think, just from two totally different perspectives. Diamond was, I believe, hurt and taken aback that information she considered to be essential to who this person is was not shared with her before getting engaged. And Carlton reacted to that hesitation and need for space, you know, with all of the baggage of being treated really cruelly and having experienced a lot of homophobia in the past.
He was more like, see Diamond, this is how people react. See, you're reacting the same way that I thought you would react, how other people have reacted, where she was kind of reacting out of just being lied to before getting engaged to someone.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we don't have any hard and fast opinions. We're obviously not, as two white, cis, straight women, we are not the authorities on queer representation, and certainly not the authorities on the ways that race and queerness intersect in this interaction. I do want to say that something I found interesting was that Queer Eyes Karamo commented on Diamond's Instagram, and he wrote, "I'm watching you and you're amazing. Carlton was not in the space yet to respect you and your feelings. His sexuality was not the issue. It was his inability to communicate honestly based on the trauma of his past." And yeah, I just thought that was interesting. So we'll kind of leave that there and move on to the other couple that lasted a bit longer.
Yeah. Next, we should talk about Kenny and Kelly.
The very charming, bland, white couple.
Yep, a normal couple.
Normal, very whitewashed
normal
couple.
Normal for reality TV couple.
Yeah.
Barnett and Amber, who Barnett was, of course, one of those guys who fell for multiple women in the pods and then made his choice.
And multiple women were very into him.
Mm-hmm.
And something I've been talking about with my friend Alex is Barnett seems to sort of embody that reductress quiz. I don't know if anyone's seen that reductress quiz where it's like, is he hot or is he just tall and white?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that is very much Barnett. And I say this as someone who does find Barnett to be attractive physically. But there's something that even in his voice signaled like overconfident, charming white man.
And we all know that guy. Like, I feel like most women have dated a Barnett in their lifetime.
And a lot of these women wanted to.
Yeah, they all wanted to. We have Mark and Jessica. Mark, who's 24, and Jessica, who's 34. So they kind of grapple with their age difference throughout the show.
You know, we'll get into this a bit more with Jessa, but Jessica has probably been the most reviled character of all of them on Love is Blind, which I think I've had a reaction to and have become a Jessica defender as a result.
But we saw some awful hate pointed at Jessica. I mean, tweets that were just
really appalling. Like, I don't even want to read them.
I'm looking at some of them right now. Just awful things. And I have talked to Emma about this, how I didn't find her necessarily likable. I wasn't necessarily hoping that she and Mark would end up together. But, you know, the fact that I don't necessarily think someone, you know, is likable or great doesn't mean that she deserves the kind of hate that was thrown at her on social media. So I think everyone needs to maybe examine what they're throwing out there into the world.
Yeah, and I think a lot ends up getting projected onto Jessica as she becomes kind of that archetype for a woman who is into her 30s, still single, like visibly yearning for a partner and yet, you know, struggling to accept the love of a good man.
Yeah. And who wouldn't unravel in these circumstances? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this a lot.
Both it's going to be messy.
We know we'd be total nightmares on, you know, The Bachelor, and I'm sure on Love is Blind as well.
Speaking of The Bachelor, we kind of mentioned when we were talking about the show how Damian and Gigi, a couple on Love is Blind, has a similar relationship to Peter and Victoria F. on The Bachelor.
Oh, yeah, you were really all about drawing that.
Yeah, and that
parallel.
One of them runs away from confrontation, no matter what the circumstance.
Yeah, Gigi likes to bolt.
Yeah. Again, this is why we do the podcast, to really watch these reality dating shows and dig into the real shit.
Yeah. Another thing we see from Damian and Gigi is the attempt to sort of make a nod at the way that political differences might impact a relationship. But again, Love is Blind doesn't quite go far enough. We see a conflict alluded to, but we don't get any specifics.
Politics can be an issue in family, friends.
You think politics will be an issue?
You are very opinionated.
If I'm asked questions.
Yeah, yeah, no, I understand that, yeah. But I'm just saying,
I do have like my own political opinions, but I'm not going to be like, that's wrong. Like, as long as I'm not being imposed on, like, about political beliefs, because those will not change.
You don't think they'll ever change in any aspect at all?
No, those will never change.
Gigi has given some interviews.
Yeah, to the Daily Beast.
To the Daily Beast. She gave an interview to them and really expressed that she didn't want to comment on it because she didn't want
people to stereotype them or react
to them
in a certain way. Emma did her digging, but, you know,
I won't reveal.
I
have figured out her.
So you can, too.
Voter registration, but that's probably, I shouldn't be spreading it around. But, yes, my point is that there are these things that we talk about with The Bachelor that I think Love is Blind at least has attempted to address, you know, surface conversations at the very minimum about finances, about race, about
religion,
about sexuality. That's not to say that any of those things were accomplished necessarily in the most productive or positive way, but they definitely acknowledge those very real world things more than a show like The Bachelor does.
Absolutely. And both shows, too, have their formula of, you know, The Bachelor starts off where there's one guy with all of these women and the goal is to get engaged at the end. Of course, Love is Blind. The goal is to get engaged at the beginning and
get married at
the end. Which, again, so much messiness, craziness, second guessing, all of that can happen within this time span. And we see that, which is why Love is Blind is highly, highly addictive and highly, highly troubling.
I mean, yeah, just again, like a deep well of sadness and a lot of food for thought about our cultural obsession with heterosexual marriage and the way that women especially face still such an intense social pressure to find that coupling as soon as possible. And yeah, I just think it, in the same way that The Bachelor tends to reveal a lot more than you might think about the world that we live in, I think that Love is Blind does as well. And that's part of the reason why we were so gripped by it.
Yeah. So Emma, is love blind?
Fuck no, Lee.
Is love blinding?
I'm just going to put it out there. If I don't want to touch you, but we have great conversations,
I'm not going to marry you.
I'm not going to marry you. And on that note, time for a break.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we'll dive deep into Love is Blind with Jessa Crispin. And alert, spoilers are ahead.
If you, like the two of us, are just always desperate to bring more coziness into your life, may we suggest Barefoot Dreams, especially now because the brand is celebrating their 30th anniversary.
With those 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams celebrates being the originators of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket.
I mean, there's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times.
If there's anything I trust more than Oprah's favorite things list, it's 6 of Oprah's favorite things list. I mean, come on. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as their collection of ultra soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are made with premium materials.
And their products make perfect gifts too.
I'm a huge fan of just swaddling myself in a big cozy robe. So I know, Emma, I'm very excited for the Barefoot Dreams robe that is heading my way right now. I was so excited to pick it out and I'm so excited to try it on. Like the perfect cozy robe.
I'm so excited too.
Oh my God, it's going to change my life, I think.
We'll just be swaddling ourselves in coziness 100% of the time. And I think we can all agree that like that is the lifestyle which we deserve and to which we aspire. Thank you, Barefoot Dreams.
For Love to See It with Emma and Claire listeners, you can get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code LTSI15.
Don't miss out on Barefoot Dreams' soft, soothing fabrics that will bring luxury to your life. Okay, so you got engaged. Congrats. Now you may be wondering what comes next.
If you're planning a wedding, the first thing you need to know about is Zola.
With Zola, you can plan your entire wedding in one convenient place. From the day you get engaged and search for the venue to the day you send out your save the dates, make your registry, and even taste your cake.
Zola has literally everything you need to make the whole process super easy and actually even enjoyable.
There's even a 5-star app that helps you plan on the go or, you know, from your couch, which is certainly how, if I was planning a wedding, I would definitely want to do it as loungily as possible.
So important.
I also just know myself. I know that planning any kind of event, like even a birthday party, can get very stressful. And so it's been really cool to see friends use Zola. It really seems to make everything a lot less stressful. And as a frequent wedding attender, I love to be able to hop on that Zola registry and just purchase a gift. Easy peasy. I know I've done it. I won't forget. Thank you, Zola.
Yeah, everything's all in the same place. It's perfect. Start planning at Zola.com. That's Zola.com.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals.
Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
And you can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week.
Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Just heat and savor the good stuff.
Plus, you can customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. And you can pause or reschedule your deliveries to suit your lifestyle.
They're celebrating Earth Day all month long at Factor. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals.
Especially since I've been back from my travels, I've gotten really out of practice with my normal meal prep. And so Factor has been really helping me kind of bridge that gap, know that I have healthy, whole meals in my fridge ready to eat when I need them.
Head to factormeals.com/LTSI50 and use code LTSI50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month.
That's code LTSI50 at factormeals.com/LTSI50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Let me set the scene. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at actually unbeatable prices.
I love it.
Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach.
Like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry.
The best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. We truly love to see it.
By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us.
And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes.
I love Quince, and I actually have a couple recent Quince purchases that I'm really excited about. I just ordered the Glow Boho hoops to have like kind of a chunkier version of my usual gold hoops to wear. Like maybe on a date night or something, and they are beautiful. They're everything I dreamed of.
Indulge in affordable luxury.
Go to quince.com/LTSI for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns.
That's quince.com/LTSI to get free shipping and 365-day returns.
quince.com/LTSI.
Anyone who's been listening to this podcast for a while, or even not that long, knows that we love Article. I mean, honestly, I'm looking around my home right now. Coffee tables from Article. That lovely chair out on my deck, Article. Our big console, Article. My bed frame, Article. This is an Article household.
It is. And it was an inspiration to me. We finally got our first Article piece of furniture recently, our new couch. And my husband and I are both constantly just like, how did we live before this couch? This is such an improvement over what we had before. It's so comfortable. It just seems to get more comfortable every day. I mean, it's the couch you dream of.
And the reason that we have both been able to find ideal furniture on Article is because Article believes in delightful design for every home.
And thanks to their online-only model, they have some really delightful prices, too.
Their curated assortment of mid-century modern, coastal, industrial, Scandi, and boho designs makes furniture shopping simple.
And their team of designers are all about finding that perfect balance between style, quality, and price, because we all want the best of all of those three things united in one piece of furniture, right?
Plus, they're dedicated to thoughtful craftsmanship that stands the test of time and, you know, looks good doing it.
Article is offering our listeners $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more.
To claim, visit article.com/LTSI, and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout.
That's article.com/LTSI for $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more.
So now it's time to get into the larger themes of Love is Blind and stop trying to avoid spoilers.
To do that, we talked to Jessa Crispin, an author and Guardian columnist who wrote a piece in The Guardian titled, Netflix's Love is Blind Makes One Wonder, Are Straight People Doing Okay?
The answer is no. But in that piece, Crispin writes that, quote, each subject is a portrait of the particular form of loneliness compulsory heterosexuality contains. Their lack of cynicism in this process would be refreshing if it weren't so baldly sad. Told their whole lives by their society, family, and social circles that marriage and family will complete them or fix them, each seems to have reached a point of desperation that leaves them open to manipulation and experimentation.
We read a lot of great pieces about Love is Blind, but Jessa really, like, just got it. Got what we were trying to say and got what we were thinking about when we were watching the show. So we really hope you enjoy our chat with Jessa.
Welcome to the pod, Guardian columnist and author of Why I'm Not a Feminist, a Feminist Manifesto, Jessa Crispin.
Thank you for being here, Jessa. We're so excited to have you on to talk Love is Blind.
I'm so glad that this is the topic that introduces me to your audience, yes.
Well, that's kind of the whole premise of our podcast, is to use things like silly dating reality shows to talk about, you know, the real shit. So
sure.
So you wrote a really fantastic piece in The Guardian, an analysis of Love is Blind. I'm wondering what kind of drew you into watching the show in the first place.
I was asked to, unfortunately. I'm not somebody who usually watches these dating reality programs. To me, they just seem unspeakably cruel. And I know people do get a kind of campy pleasure from it. But to be honest, it kind of turns me off in a way that I just generally can't. So, so watching it under duress, I guess, is a good way to have a different sort of take on it.
Totally fair. We understand that perspective.
Absolutely.
Too. I, for what it's worth, I started watching The Bachelor. I've only watched it for work. So, you know, it can be a real gateway.
Yeah. Sadly, I watched it not for work. Again, a gateway.
So why do you think having watched Love is Blind, why do you think that it has become such a phenomenon? I mean, we've seen, at least in the last week, it's been consistently the most streamed show on Netflix.
I think just the extreme version of really heterosexuality, it really gets at, I think, just how deranged contemporary heterosexuality has become, in a way that I think some of the other sort of Netflix dating shows that they've tried to do just don't. Yeah, I think that there's something about this idea that that love is supposed to be a soul connection and marriage is supposed to be only about love and never about things like rights that you get from the state. To me, it just seems totally insane in a like heightened kind of exploration of the insanity of heterosexuality.
Yet traditional gender roles are pretty essential to the structure of Love is Blind, even if the individuals featured all seem to live independent lives. And you write that, quote, while the men mostly speak of their search for a spouse as a quest to acquire the next prize in their quest for adulthood, the women suffer from their lack of emotional intimacy and company that the romantic partner is supposed to provide. So can you expand on that point a little bit?
I think that for the most part, getting married sort of adds something to the status of men and detracts it from the status of women, in the sense of that if you look at rates of things like salary, health, happiness, and so on over a man's life and over a woman's life, after marriage, men's salaries go up in a general average kind of way. They have a sort of social status that they didn't have before, a kind of respectability. Women, on the other hand, their salaries tend to go down. Their career opportunities tend to become limited, whether or not they take time off to have children and that sort of thing. And also, their sort of social circles shrink after marriage in a very dramatic way. So I do think that men go into the search for a spouse just with different expectations and desires than women do. And I think that women still, you know, we're indoctrinated into this belief that emotional completeness comes through the romantic partner more than the friendship circles. I do think that that has changed over the last 10 years or so, but I do think that certainly the kind of people who maybe go on television in order to find a life partner may be a little bit still deep within that belief system, as we could see on Love is Blind.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I find that sort of fundamental tension to be really, really fascinating. I mean, obviously, we've seen this mainstreaming of feminism, but also this almost concurrent like explosion of the bespoke wedding industry. And, you know, as you spoke about, the women's career opportunities and salaries often do suffer when they are married and have children, and men are sort of financially rewarded. And yet this like idea of almost compulsory heterosexual marriage to me feels like a greater social pressure on women. Like, is the culture just still struggling to kind of really sell straight women on this concept?
Yes. Well, one of the things that I found so interesting about the couples in Love is Blind is how, for the most part, the men were all in. And it was the women who were like sort of freaking out and having these moments of like, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, that was certainly the case with, God, I can't remember any of their names. Lauren and Cameron.
Yes.
She was much more hesitant than he was. And he was just like, look, I have this house. You can fit in the house. She's like, can I keep my house? And so I do think that there's this sort of building resistance to that you know, you can have this daydream and this fantasy that is sort of built into your life from a very young age. And then once you actually see it up close, it can be a little startling.
Yeah, we thought that a lot too, particularly about Jessica and her situation and how she kind of...
And Kelly. Like, yeah. it was really the women in their 30s, which mm-hmm. I, as mm-hmm. as a woman who is in her early 30s and, like, you know, spent a lot of years being single, like, I was just very struck by the way that you seem to see these women who had really built independent lives but who wanted partnership grapple with what does that look like and have I failed if I, you know, don't want to compromise some of these things for this one person who's really nice and wants mm-hmm. me.
Yeah, and the men were very nice and they definitely wanted those women for whatever reason. They all seemed completely sure in a way that was a little horrifying. But yeah, the women's loneliness kept being referenced. You know, the friends would talk about it. The mothers would talk about it. They themselves would talk about it. And yet this thing that was supposed to solve all of that, most of the women in the end were like, oh, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah, you talk about that loneliness in your piece. Especially when Jessica says, you know, coming home is the worst part, like coming back to an empty home where, like we mentioned, she's just kind of yearning for marriage. But she starts to question it when she, you know, says yes to someone like Mark, who she knows isn't fit for her. But she's trying to fit into, you know, what Love is Blind is kind of making her do, which is to get married at the end of it.
And, you know, it was a very nice house. So she's obviously very successful. And so this idea that, you know, she travels for work and that's very exciting. And then coming home is depressing to her. You know, that's... And, you know, we could talk for hours about the sort of failed promise of feminism, of mainstream feminism that told women that, you know, their careers were going to be the fulfilling thing. You know, we can talk about just the basic structure of the nuclear family and how it sort of replicates loneliness and oppression. But at the end of the day, it's a woman who has what looks like just about everything, has this opportunity for a partnership with somebody who adores her and just can't accept it at all.
Another couple that we were intrigued by is Amber and Barnett, mostly because they are some of the few people we see really kind of have an honest conversation about finances, which I Right. found very interesting, especially because that's not the kind of thing that you usually see on this kind of program. What was your feeling, you know, watching Amber explain to her new fiance that she had Sephora credit card debt?
Yeah, well, that was very interesting, too, because she was repeatedly talking about how she could work. She just doesn't want to work. And then the request to be a stay-at-home mom and everything. So that's obviously playing on sort of the masculine role of the provider. And so he's supposed to take her on not just as the wife and the mother who won't work in order to raise his children, but also the failed attempt at finishing school and the debt that that was created there. Like, it's just like, right? It's just an extreme form of heterosexuality, mm-hmm. And all of the traps that come with it really sort of laid bare. And I think that's what's actually compelling about the show, but not in a good way.
Yeah, it was interesting too, Barnett's reaction to that, which normally a guy would be like, oh, she wants to stay home and raise my kids. But he was a little more freaked out about it in terms of having to somehow find a way to pay off her student debts and things like that.
Yeah, all of them seemed for the most part pretty well off. Like, there was a lot of home ownership, despite the fact that they were, you know, from mid-20s to mid-30s. That's not, I would guess, the average for that particular demographic is, you know, that many people would own their home. And all of them are obviously very conventionally attractive as well. And all of them are very gender conforming, heteronormative to an alarming degree, you know, to that point where one of the men was rejected because he had had sexual encounters with men in the past. And she said some possibly homophobic things in the breakup fight after.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's perfectly dovetailing into what was going to be our next question, just about the fact that I felt like in the marketing, Love is Blind almost tried to position itself as somewhat more open and honest and progressive and deep than a show like The Bachelor, you know, one where people date across races and discuss sexuality. And yet, as you were saying, with the Carlton Diamond relationship, and Carlton is really like the one queer person that we saw featured on this show, they really seem to stumble with dealing with that gracefully. Like, why do you think that, you know, reality dating shows, other than maybe MTV's You're the One that did an entire season that was all gender nonconforming and pansexual, why do you think in general these dating shows haven't caught up with where our culture's changing conceptions of sexuality are? Like, it's, I find it incredibly frustrating. And I'm wondering how you think they could do better.
I think that the reason that they do it is because the narrative of heterosexuality is so predictable, right? There are so few new moves within monogamous heterosexuality. And it is remarkably straight, this show. There was only one interracial couple. There was only one bisexual figure who was then ultimately rejected in a pretty humiliating way, which I thought, yeah, was handled so horribly by the show to allow him to just be sort of emotionally tortured as if that's going to be inevitable for a man who has had sex with other men to face that level of not just rejection, but actual humiliation. So I think that, you know, the people that make these shows are lazy and they want easy stories, and we want easy stories. And part of the pleasure of watching a show like this is like, oh, I'm so far advanced from these crazy people. Like,
yes.
I would never behave like that. And so I think that that's why there was another dating show on Netflix, and now I can't remember what it was called.
Dating Around.
Yeah, yeah. And they had gay couples on that show, and it was nowhere near as sort of culturally, not relevant, but, you know.
It was not in the zeitgeist the way that this has entered it.
Yeah, so, and I think that maybe we're just not interested yet in that, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that whole, your comment too about, you know, laziness goes back to even the fact that we didn't even get a lot of time in the pods to get to really know these people or what their relationships were even about, what attracted them to each other. Shows like this kind of skip over the meat of things just to, again, get us audience hooked and addicted to keep watching and keep binging.
Right. They're all basically become interchangeable. Even, you know, even with Gigi and Damien, the one couple where we get some allusion to political conflict, they avoid going into any specifics or really diving deep.
Right. And I think that actually Barnett's story is maybe the most relatable one, in that these conversations are essentially the same, at least the versions of them that we're seeing. So yeah, why not just fall in love with three people? Like, what is there actually to differentiate any of them? Which is kind of the horror of these shows like The Bachelor and so on. It's just like, well, just pick one at random. Like, it's the new arranged marriage. It's, you know, maybe something can grow out of that, or there'll be a messy, dramatic breakup and they can film that too, you know? I do think that there's something truly banal about heterosexual dating that is kind of fascinating, but again, not in a good way.
I've also been really fascinated by the general public's reaction to Jessica. You know, she's got engaged to this nice guy, 10 years her junior. She struggles to connect with him sexually, and she's a bit messy, you know, into drinks a lot of wine.
Lets her dog drink wine.
Maybe into Barnett. Yeah. And sure, maybe, like, exhibit some behaviors that might make her come off, like, not the best. But what I see when I look on Twitter is just a really, really intense level of hatred and vitriol directed at her. And I'm curious why you think she's the one to have kind of emerged as this, like, universally hated villain. Like, what are we projecting onto her?
Oh, everything that we hope that we're not. I mean, sort of high maintenance, desperate for a partner, and yet unable to accept the love of that partner when he shows up. A kind of emotional messiness and too muchness, an inability to just sort of walk away from a humiliating experience and with Barnett, and immediately recover with dignity and grace. And also the sort of older woman wants a family, hasn't found the right partner, has this empty house and a too intimate relationship with her dog, because it's probably the only living figure that she has a lot of contact with. So yeah, she's everybody's nightmare as far as who they are worried that they're going to turn out to be. And honestly, like, I'm married to somebody 10 years younger than me, and it's harder than you think.
Yeah, tell us all the ins and outs of that. No, but we've been having a lot of debates in the office with a lot of people about the fact that, yes, Jessica is unlikable, which I wasn't necessarily like her number one fan. But then when you think about it in that way, you know, just because you're unlikable doesn't mean that you're wrong.
And we all know about the manipulations of how these things are edited. We all know about reality contestants who say that they don't recognize who they've been created as by producers and editors. And I do think that they're definitely playing that side of it up as well, to show her in this light, because you're not going to have a hit show like this unless you have somebody to root against.
Oh yeah, you gotta have like the desperate, you know, aging woman,
and then you also have to have someone like Giannina, who seems to be, you know, just great TV. She's just every line out of her mouth. You know, she is that stereotypical reality TV show personality.
And yet somehow it's the women that end up being like the spark plugs and the punching bags. You know,
of course,
of course. It's all incredibly revealing. And at the end of your piece, you know, you kind of guess at who the real winners of this experiment may be. You know, you say, rather than proving whether or not love is blind, the true experiment is about forcing people into a more and more extreme form of heterosexuality to see if they are capable of breaking from a lifetime of conditioning. Have you watched the finale? And if you have, do you think there are any winners?
Yes, I did watch it. I do feel like every marriage that didn't happen was probably the right choice. And I don't know if anybody learned anything from this experience. The fact that they have pretty much all signed up for the reunion would suggest otherwise. But I do think, you know, we were talking about Jessica. I do think ultimately her turning Mark down and not marrying him was not only the right choice, but the more mature choice, and not to just, you know, be like, well, this is my last shot maybe, and I can force this and possibly ruin this person's life in the process. I think that I respected her for that.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And the same thing with Kelly as well. Both of them, you kind of saw a similar thread in what they were talking about when they were sort of explaining the decisions they made, which were, yes, the right decisions to make.
Yeah, and now it's been 2 years. I'm sure they're glad they're not married and probably divorced from those people.
Yeah. I do think that the format was unspeakably cruel. I do have to say the fact of like forcing these people to make the ultimate decision in wedding outfits in front of their families is incredibly cruel thing to do. And all of the people who make the show are probably going to hell, I would imagine. I just wanted to make sure that I got that in there.
No, you're so right. It was like any ending of The Bachelor, but like on many drugs.
We think about that with The Bachelor all the time, is that why do these people have to get engaged at the end? Why can't they just date? But this format sort of forces them to not only get engaged within like 3 days, but to walk down the aisle and humiliate themselves possibly in front of people who still don't really understand why they joined the show in the first place. Some of the friends and family members who are just baffled by this concept.
Yeah, I think it would really put me off of wedding dresses for life.
Tight, low cut, yeah. Same wedding shop, same wedding venue, different flowers.
Oh my gosh. Just before we let you go, I'm curious what your take is on the aesthetics of the show, because I found especially the finale to be incredibly bleak in that way and sort of speak to what you're saying about this interchangeable nature of kind of the heterosexual marriage plot.
Yeah, it's hard to make an argument exactly against it, because the whole bespoke wedding industry and the whole like, let's create a unique experience just for you and spend tens of thousands of dollars in the process is also incredibly predatory and weird. I kind of liked that it was just so obviously some hotel basement and just really grim. It's like, no, this is really what you're doing. You are really marrying somebody that you do not know, and you're sitting in a hotel basement, probably wearing like a discount wedding dress made out of synthetic fabric. No, this is what you're doing. These are the choices that you've made that have led you here. Good luck.
Yeah, well, the men are in like the whiskey bar wine room, and the women are surrounded by their family drinking champagne and getting their hair and makeup done.
Yeah, just a whole lot of cheap white drapery. And I think that says a lot. And I think that's a perfect note for us to end on. Jessa, thank you so much for chatting with us. I mean, we just find this stuff fascinating. And for everyone listening, you should really go read Jess's fantastic piece in The Guardian.
It nails it.
Thank you.
And that's it for Here to Make Friends. Thanks to our guest, Jessa Crispin, and our producers, Nick Offenberg and Sarah Patterson.
Please subscribe to Here to Make Friends wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a moment of our Bachelor recaps and any bonus episodes. And give us a 5-star rating and review.
You can also give us a follow on Facebook and Instagram at Here to Make Friends Pod.
And you can follow us individually on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Lee Blickley and at Lee BZ.
And I'm at Emma Lady Rose.
We'll be back next week for The Bachelor's Women Tell All special.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.